timing it. Hi, everyone. I'm Carmen. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. Hi. I don't know whose big book that is, but I'm going to use it later on. I forgot mine upstairs. Thank you, Diane, for that wonderful introduction. I still remember that day. Yes, I volunteered her. I just picked up her hand and I raised it. she will do it. I think I don't even remember what it was for, but she's going to do it. She needs to do it. And to this day, I still continue to do some of that stuff because I know what it did for me. So I don't like doing this. This is one of the things that I try to escape whenever I can. And I'm only sharing that with you so that you guys can tell that I still do it. You know, even though it's outside my comfort zone, I've learned to get past those fears, walk through those fears, and don't let those fears stop me in my tracks today. And it's all because of this program. I've got 27 years of sobriety, which just blows my mind. I don't know what it is about 27 years. 26 years was no big deal. 27 years is just blowing my mind. I have no idea why, but it is, you know. To think of where I came from and that I could string that many 24 hours together just is crazy to me. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, and what I do today to continue having the blessings that I have in this program. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was really, really a terrible alcoholic. And I still remember the day that my mind snapped. My mother always told me that I was a beautiful child, never caused any troubles whatsoever. And then one day she said everything changed and she didn't know what it was. And I remember the day. Like I said, my father was a terrible alcoholic, very disruptive. There were numerous times where my brother and I were trying to pull him off of my mother. There was, I cannot tell you, this is when we had phones connected to the wall. Okay, how many times that phone got ripped out of the wall because when he got out of control, the first thing we did was call my grandma and grandpa so that they could come over and calm him down. So the first thing he would do, of course, is rip the phone out of the wall so we couldn't call. And one day I walked into the kitchen and I heard my mom and my sister talking. And I found out then and there that he wasn't even my dad. He adopted all of four of us kids when we were younger, and I had a natural father out there. And I thought, I still remember the words. I don't remember much of my childhood, but I still remember this moment, and I remember the words. And I says, "You mean to tell me all this time you've made me believe that this drunk son of a bitch is my father when there's somebody else out there?" And after that, I had that attitude, you know, to hell with all of you, and I was off to the races. And the one thing that I didn't want to do is become like my father. So at that same age of 12, I came back from vacation, and my friends had found pot. And they said, "Here, try this." And it was wonderful. I was in heaven. I had found what I needed. I had found what I was looking for. And the disease just progressed through, you know, from there. It didn't matter what I could get my hands on, I wanted it, and I wanted twice as much as what you guys were taking. I never asked any questions, well, what's this going to do to me? If you said, "Here, try this," I said, "Okay, thank you. Can I have two, please?" I was a holy terror when I was a teenager, and I remember my mom saying, "I hope you have somebody just like you." And I always told her, "That's fine that you do that, but I'll never have somebody like me because I'll never be a mother like you." Some of those things that we say when we're out there are really hard to get over. By the time I was 15, my parents had put me in DePaul. They figured I was out of control enough that I needed help, and I thought, well, I could get away from them for a little while. But see, I snuck drugs in. I had no intention of staying sober or clean or whatever it meant. At that time, I don't remember them going through my bags or anything else like that and checking. And acid was pretty easy to hide anyway, so it would have been hard for them to find that. And I think I had to check myself in. I had to sign myself in, which means I could sign myself out even at the age of 15. And I stayed for 3 days. I took all the acid that I had brought in with me, and I still to this day, and my parents don't know how I got home. And I lived on the north side of Milwaukee. And I was back off to the races and finding anything and everything. And I've been connecting with a lot of my old friends that I used to party with on Facebook and stuff like that and seeing what they're doing. None of my friends, they used like I did, you know, for a while, but none of them turned out to drug addicts and alcoholics. They were able to stop. And they tell us that we find people, you know, to meet our level, and that's what I did. I ended up leaving these people behind because they didn't use like I did, not as a teenager. They were using, they were experimenting, but I kept finding people who were using even more and experimenting even more, and I lost track of them. And today, they're normal people, you know, so why out of all of us, I mean, and there were, you know, probably 20 people that we hung around with, why out of all of us am I the one who's a drug addict and alcoholic? And I think I'm because I was blessed. Because I don't think that I would be the person I am today had I not became a drug addict and alcoholic and got to learn how to live life on life's terms with the help of a higher power in you guys. I believe that this is teaching me how to be who I'm supposed to be, how to be real, how to be loving, caring, patient, tolerant. Maybe going back to when I was a 3-4-year-old, my mother talked about who never did anything wrong and who was always a joy to be around, you know. 15, 16 years old, I ran away from home. I didn't want anything more to do with the household and what was going on and stuff like that. And I actually met my natural father. Jill yesterday during the workshop said, be careful what you pray for. Yeah, I met him. I found out I had 22 stepsisters and brothers. He had been married 6 times. He was involved in the mob. He was married 40-some years old. He was married to a 20-some-year-old and having an affair with a 17-year-old babysitter and made a pass at me, one of his own daughters. So, and he reminded me of Charles Manson. So, yeah, be careful what you pray for. You just might get it. So he was not a good man. He is dead now. I did keep in contact with him. He was actually, thank you. He was one of my amends I had to make when I got into recovery and started working my steps, because when I was a teenager, I blew into his house like that tornado that we are. Totally disrupted his lifestyle. I mean, his wife at the time had to start going into therapy, you know, because of me being there and him trying to spend time with me, and totally disrupted. And they had little kids too, you know. So I had to make amends. And we talk about going to any lengths to make amends. I had lost contact with him when it came time. So I didn't even know where to find him. So I started looking for his name in the general area of where I ran into him, you know, and disrupted his life when I was a teenager all those years ago, and wrote a letter. Sent the letter, and it came back, and it said, thank you very much. This is all very nice, but I'm not who you're looking for. And I thought, well, that's okay. I did my part, right? I made my attempt. I did continue looking for him, and actually, I think he found me again. And I was able to do it face to face. And it didn't matter what he did to me. You know, I needed to do my side. And that felt good to do. And then when he was dying and he was on his deathbed, one of his sons, the only one who was still in contact with him, with all the 22 kids that he had, there was only one that would ever go and see him. He called me and he let me know. And he was in South Dakota. And Michael was kind enough, Michael, my husband, was kind enough to drive me there so I could say goodbye, and drove me home. Again, me clearing my side so I could live a free life. You know, me doing what I needed to do. So back to the teenage years, I was totally disruptive and causing all kinds of trouble. And after I came home from running away that time and being gone for a couple of months, I was in and out of my parents' house. And then I ended up getting pregnant. And I got pregnant on purpose because I thought that children had to love their parents. Now, mind you, I didn't think I loved mine, but I thought my kid would love me, you know, and that's what I needed. I needed somebody to love me, and that was going to cure me. And the father wanted nothing to do with it, and I was doing drugs the whole time I was pregnant, didn't care. And towards the end, my mother and father asked me to come back and live with them and have the baby there. And I was grateful because I didn't have a place to go at that time. I had my son, and he came out perfect. I was very, very lucky. And I was blessed and thrilled with him. But it wasn't enough to make me stop using. Even being pregnant wasn't enough to make me stop using. You know, I didn't see a problem with it. I didn't think I had a problem with it. I thought everybody else who was out there and telling me that you can't do that stuff when you're pregnant didn't know what they were talking about. You know, because, of course, I'm a teenager. I know everything. Right? And a few months after having my son, I had some, well, my sister had some neighbors who introduced me to a guy on a blind date. And he liked to do drugs. He was actually dealing drugs, and I thought this was great. And to me, he was my knight in shining armor. He came in and rescued me on that white horse, and that's exactly how I looked at him. And we ended up getting married. And I can't tell you really anything that happened at our wedding because I don't remember it. I started using as soon as I got up that morning, and I don't even know what happened. I don't remember saying vows or anything else like that. And we stayed married, had another child, and life was good. I thought so. You know, I was able to get my drugs. I was able to do them. I was able to have my kids. I had a husband who was taking care of me. I got a job, and life was good. Well, this was, I worked at AMC down in Kenosha. Some of you are too young to even remember that name. And they were closing down the car plant. And we had the opportunity to transfer out to Toledo, Ohio with our jobs and move. So they gave us a week to find a place in Toledo to move our families and find babysitters for our kids. Very difficult to do. We were not welcome by the people who lived in Toledo. They even had shirts made up. Kenosha sucks, Toledo jobs. I was run off the road a few times when they saw the Wisconsin plates. And I'm supposed to find somebody who's going to watch my kids and take care of them, right? I happened to find somebody in the apartment complex that had just moved there and had nothing to do with what was going on. So I was really grateful for that. But what I found out that year, I stopped using. And I only stopped using for that first year I was there because I was so sick. Fear had gripped me so bad. I couldn't eat. I could smoke pot every now and then, but I couldn't do anything else. And it was a daily struggle to go into work. because I would be in the bathroom getting sick. I lived off of pretzels and milk for a year because that's all that would go down. I'd come back home and I'd visit my family and I could eat there. But when I was in Toledo for that first year, I was so gripped with fear, and I didn't understand it at the time, that it was fear that had me, you know, gripped like that. I just thought something was physically wrong with me. And then we got into more drugs there. We became the drug dealer there, and things started to relax. I started to relax. Everything was good. We were becoming friends with the people who lived there. We had a bunch of people from Kenosha who actually ended up moving there. So, you know, we were it. We were the in crowd there. And like I said, we became the drug dealer there. So everybody was at my house. Everybody's stuff was in my house. Because when they hit their bottom and they start saying, well, here, take my truck for a hit, you know, I got their truck. Take my stereo system. I got their stereo system, right? My kids are growing up. We did not hide it from them. Again, I thought this was normal behavior. I didn't see anything wrong with this whatsoever. It just shows me how sick and manipulative this disease really can be, you know, to think that this is normal behavior. Today, I'm just floored that somebody, I'll talk about Dwayne from last night, somebody of this mental capacity could think that this was normal behavior, you know. And eventually, I became my own best customer, and things started to go downhill. So we went from owning our own trailer home in a really nice trailer park. And one day we came home and the whole trailer was gone. The police had come and rampaged it looking for stuff. And then they took it because we got evicted from the trailer park. We had no idea where it was. I'm sure we got notices, you know, because it takes a lot to have your trailer home moved. But I don't remember seeing any of them. So what were we going to do? Well, there was a gentleman that had put me in charge of all his finances when he went to jail for selling our dope. Not a good thing to do, put a drug addict in charge of your finances and his apartment. So we moved in there. And, of course, we didn't pay rent there. We didn't do anything there. All I did was suck his money. And I don't even know how much money it was. And when we got, his family finally came from Wisconsin and kicked us out of there. And we had to find someplace else. And we found a home that nobody was living in. It had no heat, no electricity, no running water, and we thought, this is perfect. So there we are. I'm so terrified at this time because of fear and what the paranoia does, you know, to us when we're using, that I won't let the dogs outside, so they're pooping in the bedroom, and I just close the door. We're going in buckets and throwing it out, you know, the back door. The kids are no longer going to school. Of course, how was I going to do that? I had to use. And my husband at the time came to me and says, you know, I think I'm going into treatment. And I'm like, well, thank God, because you need it. To me, I still didn't have a problem. I thought he was my problem. Matter of fact, there was one time that I had thought he was my problem enough to start tightening the telephone cord around his neck when he was sleeping. And I believe that it was only my higher power that intervened. I think the phone rang or something like that, you know. And he woke up. But there were numerous times I would think, how could I kill him and get his insurance money, his life insurance money, so I can continue using the way I wanted to. So when he said he was going into treatment, I thought that was great. But then he told me he called our parents. And then I was mad, okay, because now this is going to disrupt my using. So both our sets of our parents came from Wisconsin. They showed up at this disgusting house that we were living in. They took our children. My husband went into treatment. And I said, thank God. Now I don't have to worry about feeding my kids. I don't have to worry about sharing with my husband. I can use and do whatever I want. All this time that I've been in sobriety, I thought my parents left me there on purpose. My mom just told me, no, we didn't. You refused to go with us. And she's probably right. You know, as much as she's forgetful now, she's probably right. I probably did, you know. I had promised them that I would check into treatment and see if they thought I needed it. Okay, that they were the professionals, that I didn't think I needed it, but we'll see what they say. So I went, and I probably told them about a quarter of what I was doing. And they said, no, we could probably do outpatient. And I'm like, well, that works for me. I can go during the day there, and I can go home, you know, collect my husband's sick pay that he's getting while he's in treatment, and I can use, do whatever I want. And somebody that... one of the dope dealers or something like that told me that, you know, if you drink vinegar, they can't detect it in your urine. And I went, oh, perfect. You know, I can pass these drops. And guess what? It doesn't work. I still have an aversion to vinegar today. Drinking a bottle of vinegar a day really cleans out your system in not good ways. And it didn't work. So about maybe 3 weeks of aftercare or outpatient, they pulled me in the room and they said, we know you're still using. We think you should go inpatient. And at this time, it was getting cold out. I was hungry. And I needed a shower. So I agreed. But I only agreed because of those things. I wanted a warm bed instead of sleeping on the floor. I wanted a shower. I needed some food, even though food wasn't that important, but I knew I was wilting away. So those were the only things, reasons why I agreed. I still, at this point, did not think I had a problem. I thought everything was normal and everybody did what I was doing. You know, of course, I'm comparing myself to the other drug addicts that are on the street, right? I'm not looking at anybody else. And so I agreed. I had no intention of staying sober or doing any of the stuff that they wanted me to do. Matter of fact, I called my parents, and I'm like, yeah, they think I'm worse off than what they originally thought, and they need me to go inpatient because I'm really sick. But I need some cigarettes before I go in, so I need you to send me some money. So they did, and of course I got a little bit of cigarettes and I went and got some more dope. And I did it in the hospital room as they were checking me in. And then I hand them all the stuff, and they said, okay, welcome to a new beginning, you know. Like I said, I had no intention of staying sober, so I just went along the motions for the first couple of days. And they told me where to go, where I needed to be, that kind of thing. And about three to five days in, I don't remember anymore, I broke down crying in my room, that gut-wrenching crying, where I didn't know what to do, I didn't know where to go, I didn't know what was going on. I think that reality was starting to set in, but I didn't know what to do. And at the end of my crying, I opened my eyes and I saw the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that they had given me sitting there on the table. And I says, well, let's see. They've been talking about this thing. Let's see. And I opened it up just to a random page, and it happened to be chapter 5, How It Works. To me, this was my higher power talking to me directly. And I started reading it. And I started thinking, maybe this can do something. Maybe I do have a problem. Maybe this is the solution. I don't think I used those words at the time, you know, because I wasn't capable of it. But I made the decision, and they talk about being at that turning point. And to me, that was my turning point. That was my fork in the road where I could go back over this way and continue doing the things I was doing and die. Or I could give this other thing a chance and do what you guys were telling me to do. And I decided, what do I have to lose? I have no idea what this is going to be over here. But I know what this is about over on the other side. And I thought, let's see. So then I started listening in the, you know, aftercare groups and or the groups that they make you go through in treatment. And I started, we had H&I panels come in, you know, and I started listening to what they were saying. They even took us to a few meetings outside of the hospital. And I said, okay, we'll do this. I stayed my full time there. And of course, there were guys in treatment that I hooked up with and stuff. And the therapist had seen us and everything else like that. So I got done with my 30 days and they said, we're going to send you back to Wisconsin. We think you need to be near your parents instead of near your husband who had been in and out of treatment and was back using. And we think you need to get with a women's group. And I'm like, oh, shit. You know, the last thing I want to be is around is women. You know, I didn't like them. I didn't feel like I could relate to them. And I thought this was the worst idea this woman had had. But I said, okay. So they sent me back to Wisconsin. I moved in with my parents who laid down the law. Now remember, this is the place I had tried to escape for many years. They kept custody of my children. They told me that I would go to a meeting every day of the week except Thursday and Saturday, that those were my days with my kids. They made me get up and take my children to school. They made me get up and feed them. All things that I had to learn again. They made me get up and shower and to become a functioning person again, because I had forgotten how to do all of that. And they had me check in at Dewey, which is, it's Aurora now, but back then it was Dewey Psychiatric Hospital, for aftercare. And I said, okay. And I went there and they set me up in a group. Andrea was in the group. The other 15 men. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so no women's aftercare group. It was all men. And I thought, well, this is great. You know, I can bullshit my way through this. I had a very low opinion of men. They were peons. They were beneath me. And I could manipulate the shit out of them. This is my sick thinking still, you know. So I was happy in that aftercare group. But the one thing that happened, two things that happened, Andrea left me alone and stopped coming back. I tease her that I still have a resentment against that, but I don't. She needed to do what she had to do at that time. But I started listening to these men, and I found out that they were just like me, that they had feelings, they had emotions, they had fears, and that I was no better than them. It really made me take a look at a different side of things, which to me was a big start of my recovery, to always look at the other side, to always, you know, try and see that, you know, I get such tunnel vision that I think my way is the only way. And when I got stuck in this group with all these men and they were sharing all their fears and their sicknesses and their desires and their hopes and stuff like that, I went, wow, this is amazing. So for me, this is exactly what I needed, was to be in that group with all those men sharing that, because I found a new respect for them. And I no longer looked at these men as they were beneath me and that they were peons. So thank you to all those men who put up with me, because I was not a pleasant person there. I decided when I got into recovery that I was going to do a step a month, because I knew how to do things and I was going to control this. And I was told to find a sponsor, and I think in my first year I had 5 different sponsors and they all relapsed. I used to say they relapsed on me, like I'm a victim and they did it because of me, you know? And that's so not true. They did what they needed to do for themselves at that time. They were on their own journey and it had nothing to do with me. And so I changed that now. They all relapsed. And like I said, I said yesterday during the workshop, I picked people who seemed cool, who seemed to be having fun with all the guys and everything else like that. I did not pick somebody who I thought was spiritually fit and who was working the steps. Well, back then, I don't know how many people really were working the steps as I look at Jeff again. Sorry, Jeff. And about when it came time for the 4th step, fear stopped me in my tracks again. And I just could not write it down. I did not have the concept of this. So I had to go back to, you know, the 2nd step for me. And I had to get a clearer vision of what I needed in a higher power. And for me, my higher power is very personal. It is my own conception of a higher power. And I worked very, very hard on getting this. Because for me, step 2 is the foundation of my program. If I don't build a higher power that I can believe and depend on when I turn my will over in step 3, then I'm building my sobriety on a shaky foundation. So I worked really hard on step 2. I always thought there was something out there. Matter of fact, when I was 12, before I found the drugs, I was going to different churches looking for a higher power, learning about different religions, and anybody that was different, I asked them to take me with them. And then I found drugs, and I found my higher power, right? So I went back to step 2, and then I went on to 3. So this has taken me longer than my 4 months. My attitude is coming back. Andrea always talks about the leather coat I used to walk around in the fringe and everything else like that. I don't remember the fringe, but my father told me I was no longer allowed to wear this leather jacket because the attitude went with it. And my attitude was getting bad again. It was good for a couple of months, and then the attitude, the effed attitude, was coming back. So he took my leather jacket away from me. My mother threw a notebook at me and said, "You're not going to bed until you're done with your 4th step. And now, my mom and dad knew about the program because 5 years before that, my father got stopped for drunk driving on Christmas Eve and almost spent the night in jail because he eluded the police because he had my mom's Christmas gift in the car and didn't want to leave that on the streets. So Christmas Eve, 5 years before that, we had the house surrounded by the police. And one of his conditions was to go to AA. So he went until he didn't have to go anymore, until it was not court ordered. So they had heard about it. But before I even came back to Wisconsin, my mother had found a meeting out in Menominee Falls that was called Alatat and was taking my kids. They were 8 and 5 when I got into sobriety. And she was taking my kids to the meeting. And she was helping facilitate them. So she knew all about the steps. She knew what I was supposed to be doing. So she threw that notebook at me and said, "You are not going to bed until you are done writing it." So I stayed up for the next 24 hours writing, crying, just putting anything. I mean, I literally just puked it all out. You know, that was the best I could do at the time. And life was good. You know, I got that stuff out. And the reason why I had such a hard time writing it is because I could tell you everything I did, right? But when I wrote it down in black and white, I had to own it. There was no more changing it. There was no more denying it. There was no more twisting my story, you know, to suit the purpose. There it was in black and white, and I had to take an honest look at it. And it was hard for me to look at that stuff. This is what I had been running from all this time, was all that crap that I had done. So when I wrote it out and I got it out there, I thought, well, I don't know that I'm as bad as what they all say I was, or that I thought I was, you know, but I was. And it came time to do the fifth step, and my sponsor relapsed just at that time. She was my first 12-step call. I got a call saying, we need your help. And that's when we went to other people's houses and everything else like that. And I got there, and she was married. She was in bed with another person, and my eyes were open. Well, hey, maybe she wasn't so healthy to begin with. And but she sure was fun, and she was nice. And yeah, she's gone now. She never did make it all the way. So, but she was a great woman. She really was. But I was going to all these meetings, probably for 2 weeks straight, and every single one of them seemed to be on the fifth step, and they all told me that if I don't do a fifth step, I'm going to use. And I had fought really hard to get to this point, because all was not kosher. You know, there were times I still remember where I was calling up my ex, who was still in Toledo using, saying, "You've got to bring me something." And he's like, "No, you're doing good. I'm not going to bring it to you and let you mess that up." You know? So I finally found a new sponsor, and she sat down with me right away and did the fifth step. And then I could go on to the rest of them. And so those were the ones that were the hardest for me at the time, actually the fourth step. And today I don't fear that fourth step anymore. You know, it really helps open my eyes to what I need to work on. And one of the things that it opened my eyes up to is that I needed to work on my relationship with my higher power. And I'll tell you, my relationship with my higher power is today the most important thing in my sobriety. The Big Book tells us that that's its main purpose, is to get us to our higher power. And that's what it did for me. As I said, it's my own personal belief in the higher power, and it has grown and evolved over time. It's just become bigger and more magnificent with each breath, you know. When I was first in sobriety, I had never gone to bed alone, so this was a scary time for me. So I would picture my higher power right there and filling up that big gaping hole that I had and telling me that he loved me and he was there with me and I wasn't alone. And I'd put my arms around myself, and to me that was my higher power holding me, you know. And it worked. I was still full of fear, which is one of the biggest things I found out in the fourth step. My whole life had been run on fear. Everything that I did was based on fear. Now, if you would talk to the people I was using with, they were afraid of me, but it was all just an act, you know? It was a persona that I put out there so they couldn't see how terrified I was. And even when I got in recovery, I was terrified to get in the car and go to a meeting. So I would reach out and say, "Okay, God, I need you, and you need to be right next to me." And I would hold his hand all the way to the meeting. I'd get out of the car, and I'd say, "Okay, God, I don't want to walk in there. I'm terrified. Please walk with me." And I'd hold his hand, and we'd walk hand in hand, you know. And that's how I got through it, to the point where I knew God was with me all the time. So this was all practice that I had to do in making sure that I had that conscious contact with my higher power all the time. I had to do those physical things. And for me, it worked. It worked well. I started to learn in the meetings that I needed to get outside myself. My first service commitment that I was actually voted for was at 3 months of sobriety, making coffee at Milwaukee Psych on Monday night, first things first meeting, the one that they're having the open meeting for here. My husband today is the one who nominated me for that. He only nominated me because he wanted me to keep coming back because he wanted to date me. Yes. He also told me I couldn't find a job, so I would go and clean, you know, your guys' houses and stuff like that. And He told me he needed me to clean his house too, but it was only because he wanted to date me. He actually got his sister-in-law at the time to come clean before I did, so I didn't see how he lived. Yeah, no manipulation there whatsoever. And I've been talking for a while. And the thing of it is, remember I told you my sponsors were not very healthy? You know, I was still married to the guy in Toledo, okay, who was moving back to Wisconsin. I was dating somebody else that one of my sponsors set me up with. And then this new sponsor I had actually told Michael that, yeah, and me, that they thought I was healthy enough for a relationship. At like 5 months of sobriety. Like, okay, let's go for this. You know, it's all I needed to hear. And if I have any regrets, which I really don't, it'd be that I didn't take that time to myself. I was so wrapped up in that I didn't take that time alone, you know, because I think I had to work twice as hard at my sobriety than somebody else who does take that time, because now not only do I have to work on myself and getting to know me, I had to get to know my children and help them, and I had to work on this relationship, which, trust me, takes a lot of energy, you know. And there again, that's where my higher power came in. There were a lot of times where I had to sit quiet with my higher power and ask, what am I supposed to be doing here? What's his will for me? And so I decided it was time to get honest with my husband at the time and tell him that although I loved him as an individual and as a human being, and I couldn't thank him enough for truthfully saving my life by telling us that we had a problem, you know, and helping to get me to that bottom, but that I wasn't in love with him and I needed to let him go so I could take care of me. And that took a lot of prayers and a lot of meditation to get to that point. I, of course, wanted him to be the bad guy and tell me he wanted to divorce me so I didn't have to take that responsibility. But if I wanted to take care of me and continue growing, it's what I needed to do. I needed to get honest with him and leave that relationship. And then my parents decided after a year of sobriety that they were going to retire, and I had to leave the house and take my kids. So this is going to be the first time that I'm actually taking responsibility for them in the last year, you know, or more, because I really wasn't taking responsibility for them when I was out there using. And again, I had to rely on my higher power to do this. There are a lot of things that I relied on my higher power for in order for me to walk through it. There's a lot of fears, a lot of stuff. There was one time in my recovery, my ex did get sober a couple months after I did and stayed that way. But I still kept custody of the kids, and he got to see him whenever he wanted to. We kept it very much between him and I, and we never involved the children, which I'm so grateful for. And he was always a good father, always there for them, always wanting to do stuff with them. So, you know, do what you need to do. And he and Michael did great at meetings together. There were times where I had to separate them and say, come on, it's time to go, dude. So it was good. But my ex came to me one year and he said, you're doing a great job raising our boys, but I want my turn. And he lived in Union Grove and I lived in Milwaukee. And my first thought was, they're mine. What do you mean you want your turn? And I had to step back and I had to take a look at it honestly. You know, that was a very, very selfish thing to say. They weren't mine, they were ours. And who am I to say that they're better off with me when he's been such a great father? And I did a lot of prayer and meditation. Michael was against it. My whole family was against it. But I sat down and I spoke with the boys, and they had to give it 3 months. They wanted to do it, and I turned custody over. Placement, I should say. So they went to live with him, and I was the one driving up on the weekends to get the kids. And I cried every time I had to drop him off. And it was the best thing for my boys. It really was. My oldest came back to live with me. He was a big city kid. My youngest stayed with his dad. He was a small town kid. And they both flourished. Well, my oldest, who came back to me, ended up having some problems with some drugs and stuff like that. But they both did better. And the relationship between the two got better. Wasn't my idea of a perfect home, but it's what worked for us. And with that prayers and meditation and telling my higher power, telling me you can't be selfish here. They're not your property. They belong to both of you. You've got to do what's right for the kids, not what you think you want. And I'm really grateful that I did that. I have a wonderful, absolutely wonderful relationship with both my boys. Do boys ever stop being mama's boys? Because I don't want that to happen. They are 35 and 33 now, which blows my mind to even say that, because to me they were just as small as Debbie's baby, you know, yesterday. My son did have, my oldest did get into his bout with the drugs and stuff, which really pissed me off. He had grown up going to meetings with me. He was going to meetings before I was. And you guys and my higher power taught me how to deal with that. And in a few years, he had run his bout, and he was done. And today, he doesn't use anymore. He doesn't go to meetings. He did it his way. He didn't want to do it mom's way. He didn't want to come here and have to deal with all of mom's friends or anything else like that. I offered numerous times, well, I'll go to, you know, the other fellowship, NA, with you if you feel more comfortable there. I'll take you to your first meeting. He said, no, I'm good. And that's what he did. And today he's married. He's got a beautiful child of his own. He accepted another girl into his life. So I got two granddaughters today. Got their own house. He's living a clean life, and he's happy. And what more can a mom ask, you know? Both my boys still give me a hug and a kiss whenever they see me, which I really appreciate. They got used to hugs because you guys taught me how to give hugs and how to give that love. And we really have a good time. I enjoy my time with them. They don't hold any grudges against me. All those, my oldest remembers quite a bit. He remembers having to take care of the younger one. He remembers having to cook or, you know, stuff like that and get him to school. He remembers that kind of stuff. But he knows who I am today and what I do today. So all of those have been repaired. All of that stuff has been repaired. One of the biggest things that I struggled with in my recovery is that I found out this man that I never wanted to be like. You know, I had turned out just like him, which my dad's got 5 years on me of living a clean life. But when I got into recovery, I found out that I always wanted to be daddy's little girl. And I wasn't. And our relationship was very rough for like the first 8 years of my sobriety. And what I found was I was doing things not for myself, but to try and impress him. So I thought he had to accept me, you know? So it was all about him and getting his acceptance. And when I finally said that that was enough, that I was going to live my life the way I needed to live my life, regardless of what he did, is when our relationship changed. So you see, there wasn't a twist in him. There was a twist in me and my thinking and what I was going to do. So I was responsible just for doing things that I knew was right for myself in my gut. And our relationship changed. It changed tremendously. Now my dad calls me and says, when can you come visit? I miss you. And my mother too. And I've definitely made my amends with them. You know, at first I went and saw them because they live in Iron Mount, Michigan. When they retired, they moved up there. And I used to go up there just out of obligation, you know, to visit them. Well, they're my parents, I have to go see them. But through working with a higher power and you guys, I want to see them. They're some of the most important people in my life today. And it's truly a blessing that I get to go and visit them and see them. So I try and get there as much as I can. You know, I talked about building that solid foundation in step two with a higher power and then allowing it to grow. And yesterday, it was yesterday, in the workshop, I talked about, you know, there's going to be times when people aren't around and you can only depend on your higher power. And I've had numerous ones of those in my sobriety. You know, life doesn't stop just because we get sober. Life continues on, and now I have to learn to live life on life's terms. People die. People get sick. You know, how I'm going to handle this. Difficult situations come up, like the one with my ex when he wanted the children. And through prayer and meditation, I was able to handle these. There was one time my husband, when he gets sick, you know, and he was in the hospital, and they told me he might die. And stuff was going on with my son and my parents at the same time. And, you know, my shoulders are up here because I'm so stressed out and I can't hardly move and I can't take it anymore. So I walked outside the hospital and I just said, I can't do it anymore. You need to do it, you know. And I turned it over to my higher power and it was just a wave of, huh, okay, he's here with me. I don't have to do this. You know, and it was really an eye-opening experience. To me, that was one of my first spiritual experiences, one of those sudden ones that come. It was like, what are you trying to do? You're trying to control all this stuff, and we're not in control. That's an illusion. We are not in control of anything. I just need to do the footwork and then leave the results to God. And I think Dwayne talked about that last night, you know. I just needed to be there for each and every one of them. I had a lot of people there, you know, by my side and stuff, but it's not the same as a higher power. Not the same as a higher power. There I feel safe, and no matter what happens. Another time he was sick, we're in Mexico, and he's deathly ill. I don't speak the language, you know. We're trying to talk to the doctors. He's passing out. He's the only one who can speak English. Had to give it up to my higher power and know that whatever's going to happen, if he dies, I'm going to be okay. And that's a very peaceful feeling. I'm going to be okay because I have my higher power. And my higher power has taught me that he will always be walking with me, hand in hand, and sometimes carrying me. And things turned out okay. But to know, to have that connection with a higher power so deep in your heart, in your gut, to know that no matter what happens, I'm going to be okay. I'm to the point where I don't even fear death for myself anymore because I'm okay. You know, death is really a part of life. You know, we're all going to end up there. And whether it happens tomorrow or in 20 years from now, it's okay, you know, because I'm going to be with my higher power. And my higher power is going to walk me through it. And it can be peaceful. I find that the more I fight stuff, the more turbulent it gets. And I don't have to fight things anymore. I have to do footwork. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean I just give up and don't do anything. And, you know, that old want to win the lottery, but I don't buy a lottery ticket thing, you know. It doesn't work like that. I have to do the footwork, and then my higher power will take care of the rest. And let me tell you how I got here, up here this weekend. This whole thing started. I wasn't even supposed to be here this weekend, and I've shared this with some of you. I have used to have school on this weekend, and when I had school, it was 3 days straight. It was very exhausting, so I might have stopped in here on Saturday. And Nina was selling the raffle tickets for the rooms. And I says, well, here, I can't come, but here's my contribution. I'll take 2 raffle tickets just to give back, you know. And she says, okay. And then Diane and I were talking, and we were going to register. Then I didn't have school anymore. And Diane and I got to talking. We were going to register for the whole thing. We'd drive back and forth together, right? Same time, Tim is calling me, and he's asking me about workshops and names for speakers and stuff like that. And I'm working my butt off to find him a speaker. I'm going to Chicago. I'm saying, Kim, who do you have? You know? And I don't know, 10, 15 names I sent him, all with contact information and stuff. And Kim sent me back a text one time, and she says, here's a list. And she put Carmen at the end of it. So when I forwarded that text to Tim, I deleted Carmen on that text, right? And I sent him all the information. Then I find out that I won the room raffle. So first thing I did was, Diane, you want to share it with me? So we no longer have to drive back and forth. Not going to school, so I do the full registration. Then a week ago, Tim calls and he goes, the committee really wants a woman on Sunday morning. All the women that you gave me cannot do it. I'm in a jam. When's the last time you spoke? And I says, it's been a little while. He's like, what's a little? And I says, I don't remember the last time I spoke. So he said, would you really help me out of this jam and do this for me? And I says, well, I'll say yes now, but if you find somebody else, you will not hurt my feelings by letting them speak. He says, no, we have our committee meeting this afternoon. I will be putting your name in the program. And I said, okay, you know, and to me, that was my higher power telling me I needed to be here. And not just running back and forth or anything else like that, but being here the whole time. And then on Thursday, I get a call from Mr. Tim again and says, my workshop people backed out. Can you help out? And I said, of course I can. Whatever you need, Tim, I will be there to help you. And that's what you guys have taught me. That's what my higher power has taught me, that I need to step aside of myself and see what's best for everybody, although I don't know me speaking is best for you guys, but my higher power obviously does, and do those things. And this, to me, was my higher power telling me what I need to do. Now, I need to have the open mind, the open eyes, the open heart to be able to see what my higher power's will for me is. And I try and do that on a daily basis. I do not get out of bed without saying my prayers. And my prayers go something like this. Good morning, God. Thank you for another day, for another opportunity to do your will. Please grant me an open mind and open eyes so I can better see your will. Please grant me an open mind and an open heart so I can do your will with love. And please, God, grant me the courage and the strength to carry out your will. And then I ask him to bless the, you know, help the newcomers and bless my family and stuff like that. But it's about doing his will. That's how my mind starts out. And I do it that way before I even get out of bed, because then I'm set on the right plane before I even hit the ground running, you know. I also do the Lord's Prayer. I'm not a religious person, and a lot of stuff talks about that being a religious prayer. But for me, when I say Our Father, it just means somebody who's greater than me, who art in heaven, somebody that's out there who's outer-worldly. Hallowed be thy name. It just means that his name is holy, and it's holy to me. Thy kingdom come. This is his land. It's not mine. This is his world. His doing, not mine, therefore humbling me. His will be done, not mine, because he's in control. I can't remember the next part, but it goes like that, okay? It's all about him, and I change it for myself because that's the way I think of it. It's not a religious thing for me. It's to remind me, to humble me, that someone else is in charge and it's not me, and that they have a better plan than what I could ever come and think of. All these years I thought I was controlling everything, and I wasn't in control of anything, not even myself. To me, nothing, and I mean nothing, happens in this world without my higher powers doing. It's just the way I look at things. People try and argue that with me, but no. My higher power is that powerful that everything happens under his direction. Maybe yours isn't, but mine is. I depend on my higher power for everything. I talk to him daily, especially when the bigger things come up, but even when the little things are there, because that helps keep me in contact with him. I also do my prayers during the night, which is mostly thank you. Thank you for your guidance and your direction. Thank you for being with me. Thank you for walking with me. Thank you for showing me where I need to be more tolerant, where I need to be more patient, where I need to be more loving. You know, I've been going through a lot of growing lessons, which everything that my higher power puts in my life is a growing opportunity and a growing lesson. There's something there for me in everything, you know. And lately, with a lot of stuff that's going on, I've been going through a lot of growing lessons. And what it's taught me is some of those people that I have the hardest time with are the ones that I need to have more empathy for, more love for, more patience for. 'Cause to me, if I had to live, which I did at some point, in that darkness that they're living in now, I would want somebody praying for me and I would not be happy. And I only want the best for everybody out there. And I also need to remember that everybody's on their own journey. And just because I'm going this way doesn't mean you guys need to go that way too. This is where my higher power is taking me, the road that my higher power is taking me on, and you might not belong on that road. So I appreciate when those challenges come into my life so that I have that learning and growing opportunity, because to me, that's what this is about, is for me to evolve into the person that my higher power wants me to be. And the only way I can do that is to go through these growing and learning opportunities. That's how my higher power speaks to me, speaks through you guys, shows me in your actions and your words where I need to grow. So it's not up to me to judge you, because guess what? God's taking care of you guys. It's up to me to take a look. Like Dwayne said it last night, that's one of my favorite things. When I'm pointing a finger at you, there's three more. Look, three more pointing back at me. So I need to turn that around and say, okay, what do I need to do to be okay with this? Because guess what? You're not the one suffering when I'm not okay with something. I am. My heart, my soul is the one that's in conflict. So I need to get okay and see what I need to do to change myself so I can be okay with it. And the thing that I always come back to is my higher power knows what he's doing. Even if I don't understand it, I've got a feeble mind compared to my higher power. He knows what he's doing. And I've just got to trust and believe in him. I've gone past the time I allowed myself. But I wanted to read my favorite part in the big book. When I close. Oh, look. Whosever book this is. It might be Jill's, I don't know, is on the chapter I was looking for, her page, so that's good. So this, I'm going to read this and then close. Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find. and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.